This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I'm talking to Tilar Mazio. She's the author of a book called Irina's Children, which is about this amazing woman, Irina Sendler, who during World War II in Poland helped rescue at least 2,500, we think, Jewish children from the Germans who were killing as many people as they possibly could. So how are you?
Very well, thanks. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, it was an amazing book. You know, it's partially because I am Jewish and I have family members who I know were lost in either Poland or Lithuania during World War II. So it's, you know, I read these books kind of avidly thinking to myself, you know, that people I never knew and never will know might have been either one of the rescued or one of the not rescued. And I'm sure that's true for a lot of people that will read this and we'll talk to you about it. You know, it's an emotionally powerful book. And of course, I think it's powerful whether you are Jewish or Catholic or anything, but probably particularly so for people who have any kind of connection to Poland and World War II.
Absolutely.
And I assume you're not Polish, or maybe you are, but what is it that attracted you to Irina's story and to, I would assume, is just an immense amount of research that you did?
It was an incredible amount of research. Some of it was talking with some of the children that Irina saved, so talking with Holocaust survivors, which was a profound research, as you can imagine. And yeah, I think you're exactly right. If you're a member of the Jewish community, or if you are from, have historical connections or present connections to Poland, it's probably a particularly touching story, you know, that it would really be part of your family history. In my case, I am neither Polish nor Jewish. I grew up marginally and nominally Catholic, but I'm not really Catholic either. So my interest in the story is that I'm mostly an author who works on women's biography. And my brother and sister-in-law did have a connection to Poland. They worked for the U.S. State Department in Krakow. And I was visiting over there at one point, not long after Irina Sendler had died, because they had just had my niece and nephew, who were then babies. So I was going to meet my new niece and nephew and visit Poland. And when I was there, my sister-in-law was one of the people who happened to tell me the story about Irina Sendler, because she's very, very well known in Poland, especially after her death. I mean, she's extremely famous. That was pretty recent. Only at the end of her life was she really well known. Really, that was only possible after the end of the Cold War. But she certainly was and is very well known now in Poland. But her story hasn't really been the subject of a narrative nonfiction account of her life in English. So when I was looking for a new topic, I remembered that I had heard this amazing story about this woman. And even though, you know, Polish culture is in some ways distant from North American culture, it's such a universal human story that it seems worth telling.
Well, it is it's just an incredible story, and of course, you get to mix the heroic with the mundane. You know, just that, you know, it shows you how any one of us could be faced with a decision to take a risk to save someone or not. And not everyone does that. Not everyone takes the heroic action, but she's not the only one. I thought that was, you know, you talk about that in the book quite a bit, that not only was she didn't do all of this work by herself, although she was one of the leaders of a group, you know, and there were many, many other people that worked with her. But there were also, of course, in passing, that you mentioned Polish families who took in and protected Jews. There were many of those people. What that means is they were risking their lives, absolutely risking their lives. And it's just incredible to think about that. I think one of the things that's powerful about this book is that it makes you think about yourself and about how you would react in a situation where you have this opportunity to make a decision that you really never wanted to have or could have imagined wanting to have. And I was really, you know, it's just very impressive to think about those people.
Yeah, I mean, I say that, you know, early on in the book, but, you know, it really bears repeating that the stories of the people who helped Irene and Sendler are absolutely humbling. Everybody who's read the book says exactly the same thing that you're saying, which is that it's a story. It's a biography that makes you ask, would I have been brave enough to do that? And the thing that has always astonished me about the heroism of those people, and Irene Sendler was insistent that it wasn't just her, when after the war, she made a list of all of the people who helped her. It was 14 pages long. And she estimated that for every Jewish child that they were able to help, it took 10 people in Warsaw risking their lives to do that. And not just risking their lives, but of course also risking the lives of their families, because there was collective justice, if we can put justice in quotes in that case, which meant that if you were found helping a Jewish person, and that might mean simply giving somebody food, right, giving them directions on a street corner where they might go and be safe, the punishment for that was the execution of your entire family, beginning with your children in front of you. So, you know, the amount of courage that it took in order to do that was, you know, really, really, truly extraordinary. And that there were so many of them. And one of the things that Irene Sendler said is that no one ever refused to help her, that they took those risks. Most of the people who helped her were women. Most of them had small children. So it's a, you know, it's a really an amazing story about what a group of friends and neighbors and average people can do when they're faced with, you know, just as you say, an agonizing choice about, you know, do I do the right thing, or do I allow something terrible to happen to this individual child? And they did the right thing. And for me, it's, you know, what is just astonishing apart from that, right? It's like that they did that was enough. But these are people who woke up every single day and did this, right? It wasn't that they once during the war did it. Because I like to think that I might have once during that war been brave enough to have done that. And I wish that I believed that I were somebody who was brave enough to wake up every single morning and do it all over again. I hope I'm that person. But the truth is, very few people are that person.
Oh, I know. I agree with you. Although, again, it's this kind of idea that a heroic act arises from the moment. It's that a hero is made, not born, you know. And but of course, the other side of that is not everyone responds heroically in those situations. And we don't necessarily even know all of the people who did respond heroically. Some of their stories are not known. They're lost. And, you know, it's sort of miraculous in a way that she survived. I mean, you start the book by really setting the scene, and I thought that was really important. I've sort of jumped ahead to the, you know, the fraught part, the heroic part of World War II, but, you know, you talk about what it was like for Irina in her earlier life, how she grew up, who her family was. You know, she was Catholic, but she was part of this kind of bohemian crowd and people who are not necessarily traditionalists, but and she was a social worker kind of accidentally. And I think that helped, you know, it sort of helps understand that the impulse to help other people that she felt for prior to the time when she was put in a position to be a hero. You know, so maybe there is something about, you know, we're preparing, you know, something is preparing us to be heroic in our lives. You know, maybe that's partially what's going on with her.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. I mean, you know, she talks a great deal about her father, who was also somebody who was a physician and was somebody who was really both politically and, you know, spiritually and morally and ethically committed to helping other people. And so she always, I think she had, and she lost her father when she was quite young. So I think in her mind, part of what she's trying to do is honor her father's commitment to helping people, even at risk to oneself. And then she was very profoundly influenced, I think, by having worked, she was trained as a social worker under an incredibly, a really inspiring woman whose story hasn't been told either. One of her professors, a woman named Helena Redlinska, who was a Jewish woman. and who truly invented in some ways the modern welfare state in Poland through social work. And Radlinska had drawn together almost all of those people who were in that network were ultimately, what I say, you know, the quote was Dr. Radlinska's girls, right? That she had inspired them with this kind of mission for social work, and there was a very strong community of them already. So these were not people who, you know, had not worked together before making common cause. And it meant that many of the people with whom she had worked before the war were Jewish. So there were girlfriends that she had on the ghetto side, and then also on the, you know, what was then called the Aryan side of Warsaw. But they were already working across the divides of religion because they, you know, they were committed to this idea of social justice. So I think right. that carried over and was really important in thinking about, you know, the war has not changed who we are.
That's true. Although, as you, you know, described, I thought really well and clearly the kind of lead up to, you know, what the Germans were doing, this kind of, you know, what they did to Warsaw and how they separated the Jews and increasingly kind of decreased the area that they were allowed to live in and increasingly built this absolute geographical separation between Jews living in the ghetto and the rest of Warsaw. And so that forced all kinds of things to happen in terms of if you were trying to help people in the ghetto, the only people who could would be people who were allowed to go back and forth. And that would be that was limited to medical and social service people. So they, in a certain way, were the only ones who were able to do that particular kind of assistance.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that had Irina not been in that position, she had not got a ghetto pass in the beginning, which she got in order to basically be a public health. She had a medical pass to work on public health issues in her capacity as a social worker. If she hadn't had that ghetto pass, she would not have ever been allowed in and out of the ghetto on a daily basis. And it was because, as you say, because she was there that she witnessed what was happening. And in particular, she began to witness that children whose parents were dying or being deported to concentration camps as the war went on, the children were left on the street abandoned. And so you had these orphans who were starving, and there was nobody there to take care of them. And that was really what it began with, is what do we do about the orphans, the street children whose parents have died in the ghetto, and how do I get them out into foster families? And then later, of course, as the war goes on and the deportations to Treblinka intensify in that terrible summer, at that point, she's just trying to get any child out that she possibly can, knowing that their parents will not. She cannot get the parents out.
Right.
They're too big.
Right.
And they can't be hidden easily.
Right. She's just doing it's kind of triage, you know, human triage, rescuing only the ones that you could rescue. And of course, the younger people they have more to gain, you know, they have a longer life ahead of them. So I guess sort of in a practical sense. But of course, it's complicated also because in so many instances, the Jewish children who were rescued were taken in by Catholic Poles who in many cases had to disguise them as being Catholic, you know, that especially only possible if these children looked Aryan, if they were, you know, not too Jewish looking, quite honestly. But a lot of them were raised then during that period of time as Catholic, and that created another tension that I actually wasn't aware of the depth of anguish on this, you know, on the part of the parents and the Jewish community in Poland about the loss of those children to Judaism. Even though they were saved, they could live, many of them were no longer Jewish.
Right. Yeah, no. And that was absolutely agonizing for those families, right? I mean, one of the things is that many of the Jewish families in the Warsaw Ghetto didn't speak English, right? They spoke Hebrew, they spoke Yiddish, but they didn't, I mean, sorry, not English, they didn't speak Polish. And so one of the reasons why children were easier to save is if you saved a child under a certain age, you could teach that child to speak Polish natively, right? So that was one of the ways that you could disguise a child, is that the child was a native speaker. And obviously adults had an accent. And so the minute somebody from the Jewish community who learned Polish as a second language opened his or her mouth, you know, it was a tell, right? And you're absolutely right that the children that mostly they were able to save, or the children they were most easily able to save, were the children who looked classically Aryan. That strong Semitic features, you know, much more difficult. It meant that that child could never be seen by anybody, right? That child had to really be in hiding and couldn't blend in. But one of the reasons that the children were very, very often, you know, systematically baptized as Catholic is that by doing that, what you did is you got one official legitimate piece of identity paper to start building that child's paper trail of an identity. So really, just as a matter of course, the children had to be baptized as Catholic. And there was a conflict not only between, I mean, not only was it anguishing for the Jewish community to save one's children physically, right? And of course, every parent wants to save his or her child's life, but only at the at a kind of loss of a spiritual death to the Jewish community. But there was also a conflict about this even within Arena's network, right? It was one of the points of conflict because within the network of people in her resistance circle, there were people both from the left, and Arena was on the far left and was a lifelong socialist, and then there were people who were quite a lot further on the right and were very ardent Catholics. And although saving Jewish children ultimately was something that brought the far left and the far right, you know, of Warsaw culture together, those who were ardent Catholic believed in saving the children, you know, for, you know, saving the children in the religious sense of Catholicism. So for me, there's that amazing story of the moment that one of the women who works with her, who's very devout as a Catholic, Yaga Petrovska, she's saving, she's hiding Jewish children, and the Germans are doing a street by street search. And, they're going to come and knock on the door. They're going to find that there are Jewish children there, and they're going to execute all of them. That's what's supposed to happen. And one of the Jewish children says to her, you know, it's because we're Jewish, isn't it? You know, if I were Catholic, would this not happen? And in that moment, you know, what she realizes is that if the children aren't baptized, they will die lost, you know, lost to salvation from her Catholic perspective, right? So in that moment, she baptizes the children, and she baptizes them not because they're going to get a piece of paper at that moment, but out of a real sense of her own spiritual commitment. And for the Jewish community, it was those kinds of moments that were really deeply offensive, right? And she tells the story of how after the war, when she presented to the Jewish community the list of the children she saved, that was what the leaders of the Jewish community said was, you know, you stole our children from us. So hugely painful part of the history.
No, it's a terrible position for anyone to, I mean, first of all, you know, to have to make that choice is unconscionable. It's not, and you can't blame anyone except the Nazis, you know, who created the ground for the decision to be made. So it's, you know, you're making decisions in a kind of philosophical, religious, and human decisions within a framework not of your own making.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, because those are people who, even those people who made those decisions, you know, Yad Vashem has still recognized those people as righteous, right? So they were making decisions out of a deep sense of moral righteousness and conscience that, you know, ultimately have been recognized as, you know, there was a conflict about this, but they were doing the right thing in the face of German evil.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. That it's, And I think it's important to recognize that I wondered about the, you know, you mentioned the list of children. She, you know, they tried to save these lists. This was really important to them. And I you highlighted that throughout the book. I thought it was really this kind of really significant theme that they absolutely wanted to, they knew that there would be a time after the war when either parents would be reunited, although obviously the hope of that happening was slim, but they wanted these children to know who they were. And so the lists of names was really, really important, but also, ironically, the most dangerous thing for them to possess and the most difficult for them to protect. Because as you mentioned, you know, or if they were found by the Germans with a list of names of Jewish children, that, you know, that would be it. Not only for themselves, but it would also make it more possible for some of those people, the kids themselves, to be found and killed. So they protected these lists, but then, and there are all these amazing events, which we don't, you know, we could say you could read about them yourself, but, at the end, you mentioned that she couldn't find the lists after the war and had to reconstruct the list of children from memory, a variety of people who were involved in the network. And do you have a sense of how incomplete that was? You know, in other words, or how complete it was, you know, were they able to reconstruct from memory what percentage of the names of children that they saved?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So Irina Sendler herself always said that the 2,500 was her best guess, right? Because they had to reconstruct it, that there were almost certainly children whose names they forgot. Now, that said, I suspect that the number of names that were forgotten was not as many as one would think, right? That, you know, when you stood there in front of parents and said to them, you know, will you trust me with your child? I will try to save your child's life, and I promise that I will write down your child's real identity, your child's Jewish identity, your child's new identity. And then they also recorded the address where the foster parent were, who was taking care of them so they could find them, right? So that the address was also part of the information. And I suspect that when you have looked into the eyes of parents and asked them to give up their child, you probably don't forget very many names. Irina said that for her whole life, and she lived, she did survive the war. She lived to be quite old. She said that, you know, even in her 90s, she died at 98, that she had nightmares about the cries of anguish of the parents who had to give up their babies. So I suspect that she probably didn't forget very many. She did acknowledge the possibility that they were always incomplete. And what had happened is that they had very carefully kept the list, and that when Irina was ultimately arrested by the Gestapo, and she was arrested and tortured by the Gestapo, when she was arrested, the girlfriends in the network understood that the lists were just too dangerous, and they buried them in bottles out in a garden. But of course, in 1945, during the fall of Warsaw, Warsaw and the Warsaw Uprising, Warsaw was completely destroyed. The estimates are that something like 90% of Warsaw was destroyed. And if you go to Warsaw, it's a very powerful experience to go to Warsaw and then see the old photos. The buildings were destroyed. It was, I mean, building by building, they were reduced to rubble. It was not collateral damage in the sense that we think of collateral damage. It was really an effort to lay waste to Warsaw. That was the mission, was that where Warsaw had been, there would be a graveyard, was the stated German mission. So what that meant is that after the war and after the Warsaw Uprising, Irina and her girlfriends went to her girlfriend's house and what had been her girlfriend's house to try to dig through the rubble and find them. But it was simply impossible. Right? The city had been reduced really to a wasteland. And so they were never able to find them. And then they sat down. But it was immediately after the war when it was very fresh in people's minds and when the children were in most cases still in the care of those caregivers. So I think it was probably a pretty accurate reconstruction. There may have been children who were missed, but I suspect not very many.
And of course, you know, given the nature of war at that time, it's very possible, or in fact likely, that many of the children that they saved, even though they might have been protected by Polish families, they might not have survived the war anyway. You know, some of those kids, you know, maybe in a, you know, the bombing of Warsaw, or, you know, just trying to get away from, you know, the oncoming Russians, who knows? There are all so many different ways for people, unfortunately, to have died.
And so many people in Warsaw after the Warsaw Uprising were sent to concentration camps. We often forget that, right? That, you know, I mean, that just because after the fall of Warsaw, I mean, Irina and her partner, Adam Selnick here, they very narrowly escaped. They had to bribe a German in order not to go to the concentration camps where they had been ordered to go. So Warsaw was, you know, was basically emptied of its citizenry, and they were all ordered to go to concentration camps, even Polish citizens, not just Jewish citizens of Warsaw.
No, many.
So, I think the death.
The number of I forget the number of Poles killed in World War II is just an astonishing number. The Poles and Russians, I think, lost the largest number of people. But I think this is right, that in Poland, they lost the largest percentage of their existing population.
I think that's also right. It is. I don't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it is. It's in the millions, and it's staggering. It is some huge percentage of. And, you know, one of the things that I really admire, but I mean, not being Polish, you know, like for me, one of the pleasures of writing and researching this story was, and it's certainly true that not everybody in Poland, or not even the majority of people in Poland, worked to save Jewish people, right? I mean, it was a very small group of people who did this. I suspect that the group of people in Poland who did it was larger still than the people who resisted in many of the other European countries, right? Like, I know that in France, the number of people in the resistance was frighteningly small, it was maybe 2 or 3%. So I think certainly there were more Jewish people more Polish people than in any other country who helped Jewish people. If you look at Yad Vashem and the list of people they say who are righteous among the nations, there are more Polish people on that list than from any other country. And one of the things that I thought was amazing, but also makes you very sad for those citizens of Poland, is that part of the reason that Poland was brutalized so significantly is that the Poles had a resistance movement very early in the war, and it was a very large resistance movement. So in some ways, it was because the Poles fought back so early and so tenaciously that they were subject to the kind of repression that they were.
That is true.
So, but I think it's an amazing story.
And the other side of that, which you touch on and that I've always felt is just horrifying to know, is that the Russians refused to help the Polish resistance and did everything possible to undermine their efforts, you know, ultimately allowing the Poles to take the brunt of German viciousness in World War II. And then, you know, of course, after World War II, as you allude to in the book, the Russians essentially colonized Poland and, you know, made it a subject state. And it became difficult. Then people who had survived World War II, I always have this terrible feeling of frustration that you could survive the World War II and then find yourself in this repressive regime where you're not allowed to be yourself after the war. So after you go through all of this, you live, you know, do these incredible things to both survive and heroically save others, and then you end up living under, you know, this Stalinist regime.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that what happened under Stalinism, you know, both in the Soviet Union and also especially in Poland, was its own kind of Holocaust. I mean, I think it's, you know, as someone who is middle-aged enough to call herself a child of the Cold War, right? Like, I think that some of the stories of the Cold War haven't been told yet, and that there will be as records loosen up, and they are not universally available still in Poland. So, you know, one of the things that in the book, I don't, you know, the story that I tell of Irina Sendler really ends in kind of 45, 46, 47, in part because after the war, she was in an equally dangerous and precarious situation. She was really persecuted by the Soviets, but those materials are still not readily available, right? It's like, it's too early historically still in some ways to get the kinds of archival materials you'd need to comprehensively tell those stories in a way that as a historian you'd feel comfortable with. Those archives are increasingly opening up, right? I mean, there's a 65-year hold typically on personnel records. So as we get further and further out, more and more materials are becoming available. But I think that there will be, some astonishing and horrifying stories that ultimately come out of the history of the Cold War as well. And certainly that was the experience of Irina's family, is that after all of these amazingly courageous things that she did in the Second World War, because helping Jewish children for her was tied, as it was for so many people, to fighting for the independence of Poland, right? I mean, she thought of helping these Jewish children as part of what it meant to fight for the preservation of her country. She thought that's what a Polish person would do. That's the country I want to belong to. And so because she was also fighting for the freedom of Poland, obviously, in the Stalinist period, that made her a suspect. And a lot of the money that ultimately she and her collaborators received to finance this came from Britain and the United States, especially from the Jewish communities in those places. That also made her a Western decadent. When she was honored by Yad Vashem, she was not allowed to have the visa. She wasn't given the passport to go to Israel in order to accept the honor. And I think that's part of what really is the largest part of the reason that you've never heard her story before, right? Is that it really was only at the end of the Cold War that these stories could be safely told in Poland. And even now in Poland, you know, I had done a lot of the research for this book in Poland. Even now in Poland, there is still a reluctant talk about what happened because people have lived there for so long with the sense that there were certain stories that it was too dangerous to tell. And it really was too dangerous to tell these stories.
And too bad in many ways, because for you as a historian and for us as readers, then you miss out on the firsthand stories then, because the people that, you know, the time goes on, you know, just because of the nature of these events being so far in the past, there's no longer anyone alive who can tell you their stories.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right. So, you know, in the case of Irina, she did, before she died, she did make handwritten notes, which are in an archive at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw. So she did take the time to write down her story. And in the 70s, at one point, the collaborators who were still alive, as they realized that people were beginning to pass away, they also sat down and recorded the history of what they had done from their memory. But because the story, they were recording it from memory decades later. So a lot of what we have is Irina's own recollection, or the recollection of her friends decades after the event. And it does mean that it may doing the archival research a bit more of a challenge. You know, it certainly is also the case that late in her life, Irina had a religious conversion and became very deeply Catholic. And it also meant that certain parts of the story when she was older were parts of the story she wasn't so interested in telling any longer, including the story of her love affair with her Jewish lover, Adam Selnikir. So those are things that, you know, one had to piece together from a series of other contemporary records from family histories. But it does mean that telling the story of the Second World War and what happened in Poland is any historian who does that needs to be very humble about knowing that the archives are necessarily complete. But your only other choice is not ever to tell the story. And that's also not a good choice. And you have to just believe that the people who told their own stories, even if they told them decades later, and even if they told them after changes of heart about youthful indiscretions, you know, we're still telling stories that were true as they understood them.
Yeah. No, I think that's important. Well, and so just before we go, because I know you have other things you need to do now, but having written this book and having absorbed and lived so much of your life now in this period, does it make you want to write more about World War II, or do you feel like you're done with that and now you'll move on to some other subject?
Yeah, no, this is a very that's a good question. This is a very hard book to write, right? For every event of, you know, somebody dying, or, you know, something happening in Treblinka, or, you know, for every one of those events that I write about, I had to read 10 or 20 of them. And it was an incredibly, I'm proud to have done this book. It was really an honor to be the person able to tell this story and to talk to those child survivors and to tell Irina's story. But it was some of the most emotionally difficult work I've ever done as a writer. Because one of the things about writing biography is that You spend more time in your life with that person than with anybody else in your life. Like, I have spent in the last 2 years more time with Irina Sembler than I have spent with my husband in my mind. Right. You know, I mean, that's just the reality of writing that kind of a project. And so, it was very difficult. And I wrote the book, while I live with stepchildren, and I have the nieces and nephews from Poland visiting the summers. And writing this book while you're listening to the voices of school children playing outside, right, and, you know, running around and screaming with pleasure at the same time that you're trying to wrap your head around how do you tell the story about the death of children, right? It's an exquisitely painful and difficult a difficult moment. So for me, this was the second book that I had written about the Second World War. And I don't think that I will write another book about the Second World War. I think I have spent enough time in my life reading about the Gestapo. And I know more than any sane person should know about the Gestapo and the truth of Treblinka. And like I say, an honor to write it, but I think for my own emotional health, I probably need not to do that again. It was a very powerful story for me to write. So my new book is the biography of Eliza Hamilton. So looking forward to that. It's a much more also an amazing story of another, you know, just incredibly incredibly important and inspiring woman, but not quite so dark story.
Well, I think that you deserve that respite, it sounds like. And I can only imagine how difficult and painful it was. But I think, as you kind of probably know, really worthwhile. I think it's an extraordinarily wonderful book and a great story about a great woman and really uplifting, even though it is incredibly dark and painful. It's just, I'm really glad to have read it. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I put my heart and soul into that book, so I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it. It's an important story.
It is. Yeah. Well, thank you so much to Laura Mazzeo for talking to me about Irina's Children, A True Story of Courage. I really appreciate it, and thank you again.
Thank you. I appreciate your reaching out to talk. Have a great one.
You too. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. Thank you very much.